care enough to ask people that are dying? Ask yourself, do you care whether alcoholics and addicts continue to live and die? Do you care whether they die? Do you care whether you die? Do your amends have anything to do with drinking again? Does this current list of unmanageability have any connection to a drink? Do the areas where I'm running my life on self-will have anything to do with me taking a drink? And if they don't, if these lists, this list of current unmanageability, this list of current agnosticism, man came to our group one time in Santa Monica, great guy, you'd heard of him, big book stuff, does the 1 through 9 on a regular basis. Young girl in our group raised her hand. She said, could you tell us about the last time you went through the steps, the current unmanageability, the current agnosticism that you discovered? He said, current agnosticism? Not only do I not know what you're talking about, I was only agnostic once, and that's when I got here. How could there possibly be any current agnosticism? But you won't be able to see the current agnosticism if you don't get that list of current unmanageability. The manifestations of 52. And let me share an experience I had with the chapter to the agnostic that blew my mind. The first proposition in the second step is, do you now believe, or are you even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than yourself? A lot of people think the first consideration in the chapter to the agnostic, the first half of step two that we call it, is, do you now believe in a power greater than yourself? Like you take step one, you get to the first half of step two, and you're supposed to have some great belief in a power greater than yourself. It's not. It says, it could be right for the guy with 2 days. They were doing it back when. Do you now believe, or are you even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than yourself? If they have any kind of first step experience, they got to know there must be something or they're screwed. You're going to come to believe in God the first time through the work the same way you came to believe in booze and drugs. Let me say that again. You come to believe in God the same way you came to believe in booze. How'd you come to believe in booze? Did you ever get absolute faith in booze by watching somebody else get drunk? No. Did you ever have faith in booze by looking at it through the window of the liquor store? No. So how'd you come to believe in booze? And if you're like me, it became a power greater than yourself. Some new idiot says, I'm having trouble believing in a power greater than myself. My God, you've had a power greater than yourself in your life that you put before every single person and every single thing, including your own life. You've had experience with a power greater than yourself. So how'd you come to believe in booze? I saw that it worked in others. I made a decision. That wasn't enough because deciding to get drunk never got me drunk. I had to get up, put one foot in front of the other, take some action. Boom, 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 boom. I got some results. Then I had faith in booze. Same process in this book. You see that it works in others. You make a decision at step 3. You take some action in 4 through 9, which is the same as walking to the liquor store. And then you come to believe in booze. You come to believe in God the same way you came to believe in alcohol. So, I get to that first consideration in step 2. Do I now believe, and I have some time now, do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself? That question will do nothing for anybody who's had some time or done some work. Of course you do. But if you add one little thing to that question, to that consideration, to that one short question they say we need to ask ourselves, it'll make it as relevant to you the second time as if it's your 50th time through the work. And here's how it goes. Based on what I've seen in step 1, do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that this power that I say that I believe in can take me past where I am with every area I've seen on page 52, including freedom from alcohol, that I might not even know how it would feel? Past here. Because what you're facing in the second step, and what you're going to face in the inventory, if you've been around for a while, is not what you do when you're powerless over alcohol with an unmanageable life. You're going to be facing what the fuck you do with power, with manageability, with the grace and glory of God in your life. And you're going to write about those times you thought you were so clear in 10, 11, and 12, wasn't nothing touching you. You give yourself to 1, 2, and 3 again, and it does its magic, and all of a sudden, gee, there ain't going to be much of an inventory. I've been in India for the last 3 years, been studying with so-and-so and such. How big could the inventory be? Could I really owe that many amends? I'm a pretty spiritual guy. Set aside prayer opens you up. 1, 2, and 3 does its magic. And every time I've started the work, my head says the set-aside prayer ain't going to work. Haven't I risen up a little bit higher than the set-aside prayer? Where, I mean, I know prayers in other languages. I know mantras. I know how to use a mala. I know this and that. The set-aside prayer is not going to work. There's not going to be much new in 1, 2, and 3 for me. This is my mind in March when I asked Mark to take me through, to help me. There's not going to be much of an inventory, and there certainly won't be very many amends. And isn't it great when you're surprised by not only the process, but you know how you know when God's in your life? When you're surprised by your life, too. If somebody would have told you where you were at a year ago, where you're at now, and it's pretty much the same, you got to ask yourself some basic questions. But if somebody would have told you where you were at 5 years ago, where you were going to be today, and it's an absolute surprise, because you know how you know. You know how you know when God's working in your life? When you feel lucky. You know how you feel when God's not working in your life? Unlucky. And you know how it feels to feel lucky? You're surprised. You're passionate. You're awake. You're feeling great about what's going on in your life. And then you hit a wall. And you've done some work. And you're wondering why. And you ain't talking about the amends that weren't finished. Or you have finished amends. And you hit a new wall. It's like, do some work, get a power, come to the new wall. It's just a new wall. Hello, new wall. Am I going to go around you? Am I going to just sit at the base of you? I'm going to stay on this side of it? Or am I going to ask God to take me through the new wall? And you'll see the new wall in the list of the current unmanageability. The manifestations of page 52, which will become your agnosticism. So if you've been around and you get to that question, do you now believe, or are you even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than yourself? And it's a stupid question because you know there is. Add to it that can take me past here. Here. This stuff that I've located. The first step has located me. Here I am. Do I believe this power that I say I have so much faith in can take me past where I am? How are you going to work with that? Go through every, because the logical mind would say, now that you've answered that, or the way to answer that consideration would be to go home and see how much faith you got. Build that faith up. See how much you got. No, you're going to find that if you got the right question, the chapter will do this. And here's what you do with that first consideration about past here. Go through the chapter, mark every word or statement or question or anything that strikes you that would help you face where you don't believe. Doubt. Skepticism, worship of things, people, sentiment, money, yourself, your mind. And even with a better motive, there's stuff that's holding you back. The sea, the sunset, a flower. The box that I put God into as my choice of being everything last time. Because the box gotten a little small. Because it was my conception of everything. What about coming to the next proposition, God is everything or nothing, without fear and with no size to the container? Because every time, for many, many times through this work, I chose God as everything, but I built the container that everything meant. Could God have had something to do with September 11th? Absolutely not. That's the devil. It's evil. Boom. September 11th started with September 11th. We had no responsibility. Our troubles were of their making. On and on and on. Could there be a bigger picture that God is either everything or he's nothing? Now, how am I going to approach that with stuff going on in the world? Maybe there's a bigger picture. Maybe there's such a thing as what goes around comes around. We all understand that from the streets. Anybody in New York knows what goes around comes around. Where I come from, they happen to call it karma. For every action, there's a reaction, right? There ain't no guy up there with a million tentacles, one attached to each of you, answering the phone, answering your prayers. I believe there's an energy in this universe that underlies the totality of things. From the book, Creative Intelligence of the Universe, underlying the totality of things that set up some specific laws. You live by the laws, you live well. You don't live by the laws, you don't live well. I haven't been hurt physically. I've never been punched. I've never been in jail. I've never been in a police car. And I've never been back to the penitentiary. And I've never been ripped off in 20 years. And before that, I was ripped off, punched, pistol whipped, in jail, in the penitentiary. And that didn't change because alcohol went out of my system. It changed because I got the power to start living from my heart the way I always wanted to. So you make the consideration. Past here, is there more? You face the doubt and the prejudice and the current agnosticism you have about it. You write that list out and you say, my God, it's the same stuff I wrote out as my list of the current unmanageability. Then how do you get from that to choosing everything or nothing? Go back through the chapter in another color and see the words or phrases or statements that are like more positive, that make you feel a little more comfortable, that take you from that. As soon as a man can say he's willing, he's well on his way. As soon as prejudice is laid aside, boom, the cornerstone. What statements or words, what things can I consider that would take me past my doubt? But you got to see the current agnosticism to get past it. How are you going to get past what you don't see? God don't take you past what you don't see. He's not that rude, and he doesn't come unless he's invited. First spiritual principle of AA. God ain't rude. He only comes when he's invited because of his love, not because of his choosiness. I'm not going to pick you. You're not calling me the right. If we had to call God the right name to get here when we were new, a lot of us would be in trouble because I called him some names. No, you got to call him the right name. No, you don't. Drop the name. Well, what's the name? That's my conception. That's my conscious contact. How are you going to take away my conscious contact? Face the doubt. How much did you believe when you got to the second step this time? This much. The book says, well, maybe this much is about money, people, things, sentiment, memory, fond memories, emotion. And you see, it locates you just as much as step one located you. Then you make your choice. Yes, I choose everything, and I'm going to drop my conception about the container. And I can do that from the ABCs. I can do it forwards, I can do it backwards. I'm having trouble with inventory. I go from the ABCs through the first, am I convinced? Through the first requirement, my life run on my will. Through the third step decision, reaffirm the decision. Boom, I'm back in inventory. I can do it forwards, I can do it backwards. How about those that want to go to lunch and stay and come back at 2 o'clock, feel free. Those that want to take a 10-minute break and ask any questions, let's say between 1, 2, and 3 steps. Come back, we'll answer questions until 12:30, and then we'll have lunch until 2. But let's keep the questions at 12 to steps 1, 2, and 3. This afternoon, we'll talk about 4 through 9. We're going to have more time over the weekend to entertain questions. We're spending the entire afternoon on 4 and 9. So I wanted to ask a question of the group before we ask for questions from you. With a raise of hands, and think about it for a moment. How many people in the room, their number one priority is to stay sober? Staying sober is your number one priority. How many? Isn't that interesting? There's no right answer, but let me raise a consideration. Isn't it interesting that if your number one priority is to stay sober, you've just made your number one priority the only thing you can't do? How many people in the room is their number one priority to seek that which is keeping them sober? It's very subtle, but it's very profound, because I'll tell you what. If this is a bottle of alcohol, and I'm putting all my effort into keeping myself from this bottle of alcohol, you know what I stay focused on? The problem. The problem. Alcohol. Keeping myself from drinking. And if this is God... But once I have a first step and I see there's nothing I can do without God to keep myself from drinking, then my number one priority is to seek that which is already keeping me sober. So, questions on 1, 2, and 3.
And let's see, I think it'd be nice if you'd come up and ask your question. I'd like to get the questions on tape.
They can ask and we can repeat.
Okay.
Go ahead, ma'am. Marco responded to this. The question was, what's the difference between being driven and spiritually motivated?
I'll give you an assignment. First of all, look up the word driven so that you understand what the word means. Really, I don't know if there's any difference. Now, being driven by self-will, if you look up that word, what you're going to understand is there's no choice. My experience is no. Your head is already in the tiger's mouth, and you can't speed it up, and you can't slow it down. Go along for the ride. And does it really make any difference? Based on the results and the effect and knowing God. And
the only thing I would say, as long as you're clear on who the driver is. Next, Danny.
My name is Danny. I'm an apple. I was approached to go through the steps again. However, I'm in step 9, continuously following through with the amends, making appointments. And I'm struggling with the idea whether step 1, 2, and 3, again, through the process, will enhance where I'm at, or will it be bringing me back to a place to avoid where I am?
Danny asked that he was approached to go through the steps again, but he's in 9 and they're flowing, and would 1 through 8 take away from that movement or add to it? I would say, who approached you to go through the work again? I mean, why did somebody approach you to go through the steps again? Did you approach someone or did someone approach you? That's a little different. His sponsor suggested, since he's come from treatment, he comes from treatment in 9, he's getting to know a new sponsor here. His sponsor suggests to get that foundation, that connection together to do 1 through 8, let him get back and do amends. My God, I don't know if it was me, and I would say if the power is there to continue making amends, you can review 1, 2, and 3 at any time to enhance that. If the power runs out to continue amends and they're not flowing, you'll be driven back to 1 through 8.
Yeah, I would say the same thing. I would continue making amends, take it into prayer and meditation, and you can always review the first 3 steps or maybe some more inventory. You're going to be doing a lot of inventories over the years, but keep your focus on the 9th step. There was a question.
Hi, my name is Tracy.
Hi, Tracy.
Hi, Tracy. This question, I never really said anything, but I got to ask this question. They talk about resentment is the number one offender. I know we're not the 4th step. It kills more alcoholics, and God makes that possible. How does God make that possible?
She said resentment is the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else, including alcohol. God makes that possible. How does he make that possible?
The phrase God makes that possible is prior to the discussion about resentments. You got 2 separate issues here. Book says resentment's the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. Is your question, how is it that God allows that? Is that what your question is?
Like, will God kill you or you kill yourself? I'm
behind the resentment? No, that sentence is behind this idea that you got to get rid of your selfishness. Inventory is the vehicle to get rid of that selfishness. They're in two different places in the book. You're putting God makes that possible behind resentments, kill more alcoholics than anything else.
God makes that possible is where it says, our troubles we think are basically our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must be rid of this selfishness or it kills us. God makes that possible. They're talking about selfishness. Resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From resentment stems all form of spiritual disease. It's like Mark said, it's two different things. God makes it possible to get free of selfishness by removing it, by giving you the power to move past it, to live unselfishly. God makes it possible by removing the things that block you from more power to live unselfishly.
Hi, my name is Kel. I'm an alcoholic addict.
Hi, Kel. She's in the work for the first time. She's only on one very first assignment, which is to read the first 164 pages. Is it possible for her to work on her resentments? She's developed a resentment while working on step one. Nobody can relate to that one.
And I'm afraid that resentment is just a force blocking me.
Well, you got a million other ones, darling, so stay focused on the assignment. Stay focused on 1, 2, and 3. The power will be there to move you through the resentment inventory. Yeah. You can't work on your resentments. She was one of the people that raised her hand last night when we asked who still believes they have a choice whether they drink again or not. She has a problem with that because she still thinks she has a choice.
Let me read something to you. There's two areas. It's on page 24. And they're talking to you and I about the state you're in now, which is you're sober. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, meaning we don't know, have lost the power of choice in drink. Sober. And now it's going to tell you why you've lost the power of choice in drink. Because our so-called willpower, which is, by the way, where choice comes from, becomes practically non-existent. We're unable, at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. There isn't anywhere in this book where you can show me where it says I'm given the power of choice. Now, when you get to the 10th step, that's where you're told some very interesting things, but the power of choice being given back to you is not discussed. In there, it says that you have ceased fighting anything or anybody, even alcohol, that you've now been restored to sanity, that you've been placed in a position of neutrality, that it was a miracle, it was a gift, and that the problem has been removed.
Because in a fit spiritual condition, there's about as much choice to drink as there was to not drink in an unfit spiritual condition. So let me ask you this. Is there any choice once you put alcohol in your system over how much you're going to drink? When you stop drinking, is there any choice about how long you're going to be able to keep yourself stopped? Then where's the choice? She doesn't have one.
Yeah, but what's great is I think it's great that you're willing to challenge these belief systems. I read at the very beginning, a lot of what Joe and I are trying to do here is make you all begin to challenge some of these belief systems and start asking yourself, where are they coming from? And that's why I said to you, don't let anyone read your big book. Your belief system is not consistent with this big book at all. Does that make sense?
How long since your last drink? 16 months. Did you choose a God that you want that would give you a choice to drink again? What's your will where alcohol is concerned? What's your will? To drink. What do you do? What do you decide in step three? To turn your will over. A lot of people think the third step is turning their will and their life over to the care of God. If that was it, there'd only be three steps. The third step is not turning your will and your life over the care of God. 4 through 9 is turning your will and your life over the care of God. But if you've done that, if you've given your will and your life to God, where's the choice? My will is to drink. Have I taken the action necessary to turn my will and my life over based on the decision I made in step three? Next. My name's Marty. I'm selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid. Welcome. She's asking Mark to respond to his comment about don't let anybody read your big book for you. How do you work with somebody based on that principle you spoke of?
We answer some questions before we ever open the book that we've talked about. And then from there, we're going to open and we're going to start on the blank page and then move to the title page. And we're going to go through the book. And when the book gives us an instruction, we're going to do it. That's how I work with someone. Pardon me? It goes back and forth.
He meant don't do the work. Don't let anybody do the work for you.
But I meant more than that. And I meant also, the young lady shared, she had a belief system, she has the power of choice. That is not consistent with the book, it's not in the book. She has that belief system because she's letting someone else read her big book for her. This is life and death stuff. Don't let anyone read your big book. These people say, well, you can't make all your amends. It is not consistent with the book. Or I'm not going to do meditation, it's too fluffy. It's not consistent with the book.
He means like when people quote the book, they'll say, you know that part in the book where it says today you'll have a choice and you can work on your character defects? That's letting somebody else read your big book.
Or just don't drink and go to meetings. It's
not
in the book.
You'll never recover. Where's that?
That's what I mean by that. So many people miss out on so much of what this program can offer because they let other people read the big book for them. And you know why we do that? It's an easier, softer way.
First thing my sponsor said to me about this 20 years ago was use it as a bullshit sifter. She asked, when you're new and you're hearing a lot of confusing things and you hear a slogan like, I came to believe. How is that consistent to letting someone else interpret it for you? I think Mark would say the same thing. So would I. Where does it say that in here?
Yeah, and not only that, I did not come to AA. I was brought to AA by a power. Kicking, screaming. I did not come to AA. I did not come to. I was sound asleep dreaming. I was awake for at least 2 years. I got awakened through probably a series of events, and I came to have an experience. In other words, again, it's just cute little stuff that, I mean, if it works, that's wonderful. I've shared some stories with you. I bury a lot of people, you know. So am I kind of a hardliner? If it's not in the book, it ain't. Yeah. You know, I'm not interested in your program. I'm interested in the program. Follow me. I'm not interested in your sponsor's program. I'm interested in the program as outlined in the big book. Why? Because it's a deadly, fatal illness, and it kills and kills every time. So, you know, I'm in a position of neutrality with all that. But again, I just have my own experiences over the years. And if it ain't in there, it ain't. Then what I'm just getting is some opinion, and I understand it's an opinion. The tragedy is, though, there's a lot of people in AA that don't believe it's an opinion. They believe it's a fact. They believe it's out of the big book. So then they develop a belief system. And then somebody comes along who's got experience with the book, and they assassinate their character and call them a big book thumper.
Has anybody ever seen the arrogance of, I can't, he can, I think I'll let him? Oh, isn't that a nice thing? I think I'll let God. My God.
We're the only group, well, we're not the only group, but it's very prevalent in our group. We have the subject objects confused. Who's God and who's the drunk? In the third step, you're going to make a decision to turn your will and life over to that which created your will and life. The subject object, they're a little confused. You follow me? Oh, we're going to let God do all this stuff? Oh, isn't that sweet?
My spirit started to have a problem with the first line of the third step. God, I offer myself to thee. Wow. That which created me, that which gives me each breath, each thought, each emotion, I'm going to offer myself to thee. Gee, that's a nice thing for me to do, isn't it? How about this one? AA is a selfish program. I think it's one of the most selfless programs for some of the most selfish people in the world. It's a selfless program, right?
See, this morning, you know, Mike and Ken and I were, you know, we were running, we were talking about this, and Mike had made a statement of something to the effect of, well, someone asked him, why do you keep going to those and these kind of things like this? And I said to Mike, that's because that person thinks that you're involved with some decision to come to a thing like this. I said, Mike, I said, you know, I love where I live. I love what I do. I like to run in this beautiful trail that I can run on. And instead, I'm in a cramped, tiny little room at the Marriott, you know, and running on a treadmill looking at traffic. And, you know, I got 3 hours sleep last. I said, well, who in God's name would choose to come and do this? You understand the point I'm trying to make? It is a selfless program, see?
One of the third step considerations. Am I willing to live life on terms other than my own? Another consideration we didn't mention around playing God. Here's a great one, given to me once. If you had something to do with your own creation, wouldn't you have done a little better job than God?
Any more questions?
He asked me to elaborate on my comment about karma and September 11th. I think for every action, there's a reaction. And I think our country has taken some actions that brought a reaction. I don't think September 11th began September 11th. I think our troubles are of our own making. I think we've done some stuff in other countries. I'll give you a quote from the Dalai Lama. He said, and he's a very compassionate person, he said America needs to take the responsibility and admit that they were a part of bringing it on by not responding when it happened to others and doing it to others. I think what goes around comes around. I think there's a bigger design than we see. I think there's a wheel of life that explains to me why a baby, an innocent child, is born and dies 2 days later. There was something needed to be burned off, and that's all they had to do to go on to the next thing. 1 day, 2 days, do this, take a couple breaths, and boom, you're going to be in the next one. I think if there wasn't this wheel of life, this karmic law in effect, we wouldn't be here because the planet would have been full a long time ago. If all it was about God's love and you'll live forever and nothing will ever go wrong, paradise on earth. It's just not that way.
You want to talk about the power of resentment. Bin Laden, it'd do him good to write some four-column inventory. I mean this. I was talking to a pal of mine, and I realized 9/11 happened behind the resentment. It happened behind the resentment. Column 1, U.S. of A. Column 2. Blah 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 blah. Third column. This is how they'd affect me. Wow.
I'll tell you something though, and it's not stuff that we should really be getting into. But I'll tell you, to think that the Muslim religion is filled with fanatics. I'll tell you this: there's about as many religious fanatics in the Muslim religion as there is in the Christian religion. There's great Christians. There's wonderful Christians. We know some of the stuff going on in Christianity nowadays. Atrocious, unforgivable, sinful stuff. Probably forgivable by God. I'm not God. Some of the things they're debating now should not even be considered to be debated. If you did it, if I did it, there would be no debate. Here's one of the things I love. Some agency gets in trouble. They go to the court or whatever, the Supreme Court, and they say, now here's what we'll do. We'll make a thorough investigation of our agency and we'll get back to you. Now imagine me going to court and saying to the judge charged with whatever, let me tell you, judge, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll make a thorough investigation and I'll get back to you in a couple months. Right?
Questions on the first three steps? We got time for a couple more.
He's asking, when the book promises that we will recover from a hopeless state of mind and body, alcoholism, does it mean much more?
Well, it's in the beginning of the book here, you know, it shows the story of thousands of men and women recovered from alcoholism. And, of course, in the foreword, the first edition, it shows it precisely how we recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body.
Right. I've recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body because I'm not craving booze and I'm not obsessed about it today. That's the hopeless state of mind and body. There's a lot that's going to go on after that. There's a lot of things to continue to grow in. But as far as alcoholism, a hopeless state of mind and body, the craving and the obsession, I'm in a recovered state. Do we reach some state of perfection? No. We're not saints. We're willing to grow along spiritual lines. Right. I wonder how many of us, though, ever work with that line. We claim spiritual progress. We always say, it's not about perfection. It's about progress. But how do you, in a humble way, claim spiritual progress? You share the miracles. You share the miracles in your life. You give hope to the new man. What hope could I give to somebody in this room that I met at the break that has 2 days if I said to you that I'm still powerless over alcohol and my life is unmanageable? Where would the hope be? That you'll always be recovering. That you're not going to have power in your life to make decisions along specific lines. You're not going to be able to have a manageable life. Something's not going to stay between you and alcohol. That you're not given the power to help others. That you're not given willpower you can exercise along specific lines all that you wish. Where would the hope be? Because I want to remain irresponsible and say to you, hey, I'm powerless over alcohol and my life's unmanageable. What can you expect from me?
One more question.
She's asking what we mean when we define by the word spiritual consent.
Yeah, there's There's two spiritual laws I'll work with. One is the spiritual law of caring. I do not help alcoholics who show me through a course of action they don't care about themselves. However, if they show me through a course of action they're willing to take, they do, then I must be there with them, and I will be. Spiritual consent is this. It is where you have given me permission to come into your life, much like when it talks about in the chapter Working with Others, both you and the new man walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. But I only work with people who've given me spiritual consent. And by that I mean what they're saying to me is, I have just given you consent to say anything to me at any time about any form of my behavior. That's what I mean by spiritual consent.
And we can add to that principle he mentioned first, the principle of caring. The principle of caring goes like this, and many of you have seen it. If you don't care, I can't. You can try to convince yourself you do. You can try to believe you do. But if the new guy doesn't care, you can't. And if he does care, you can't not care.
Let's have some lunch.
2 o'clock. Good afternoon. My name's Joe. I'm an alcoholic. We thought, Mark, we wanted to start with a thought and maybe a little silence.
This reading is called Compassion. It says, once you've seen the face of God, you see that same face on everyone that you meet. The true God has no face. The true God has no name. But we cannot identify with that until we're of a very high level of insight. Until then, the gods with faces and the gods with names are still more worthy of veneration and study than the illusions of the world. With long and sincere training, it is possible to see the face of God. Holiness is not about scientific objectivity. It is about a deep and clear recognition of the true nature of life. Your attitude toward your God will be different than anyone else's God. Divinity is a reflection of your own understanding. If your experience differs from others, that does not invalidate your sense of godliness. You will have no doubts after you have seen. Knowing God is the source of compassion in our lives. We realize that our separation from others is artificial. We are neither separate from other people nor from God. It is only our own egotism that leads us to define ourselves as individuals. In fact, a direct experience of God is a direct experience of the utter universality of life. If we allow it to change our way of thinking, we will understand our essential oneness with all things. How does God look? Once you see God and know God, you will see that same face on every person that you meet. How about we take a couple minutes and do a meditation? Ask the God of our understanding to open our minds and hearts and provide us with some energy for this afternoon and allow us to have some fun and lightness with this incredible thing called life.
Without opening your eyes, staying in that place, which is the place where truth comes from, where God is, both in and outside of you, all around you. I would like to do just a short guided meditation on the pertinent points that we've covered. Is this work, as outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, what I want to do? Am I willing to go to any length, even though I may not know what that might look like, to do this work and to seek God's will? Why? Why do I need to do this work? And why would the group or person that I've chosen? Am I willing to look at and begin to admit the areas of my life where I'm being dishonest with myself and others? Am I willing to ask that which I believe in my own way, from my own heart, for an open mind and a new experience with the things that I would like to have an open mind and a new experience with? Do I believe this book is laid out to show other alcoholics precisely how to recover, and that that's the main purpose of this book? Am I willing to admit from where I am now that in and of myself, without God, that I am nothing, and that without God I'm lost? Does my experience abundantly confirm that once I put alcohol and or drugs into my system, something happens where I lose control over the amount once I start? Am I willing to look at that with alcohol? Am I willing to look at that with drugs or whatever my problem might be, whatever the symptoms of my problem might be? These are the symptoms, but it's very important to have a clear first half of step one. If I'm scattered with many, many issues and many, many problems, I will continue to feel scattered. I should start with my primary symptom. Am I willing to ask God to help me fully concede to my innermost self the truth of my first step? Am I convinced that I am not like other people? Or presently, has that idea been smashed, that drunk or sober, I'm an alcoholic and I cannot manage my own life? Am I convinced that at a certain time, and I might not know when that certain time might be, how it would feel or what it would look like, that there will be no effective mental defense against the first drink or drug, and that no human being, no human power can provide that defense? And am I convinced that whatever it is that I'm powerless over, whatever the truth is in the first half of step one for me, that my defense must come from a higher power? Do I believe I'm suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience can conquer? And do I have any other alternatives but the two on page 25 to go on the best I can, blotting out the consciousness of my situation as best I can, dying an alcoholic and or drug addicted life, or number two, to live on a spiritual basis? Do I have any other alternatives? Is lack of power my dilemma? And do I need a power by which I can live? Am I committed to finding out where and how to find that power? Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there is a power greater than myself that can take me beyond where I am with everything I've seen in the first step? My trouble with personal relationships, my emotional nature, my dependencies, medication, love, effectiveness, work, passion, a passionate life, money, being of real help to other people, past where I am with fear. Do I believe God can take me past here? And not only do I believe, can He? Am I willing to face the doubt and reservations that I have about will He for me as I am with the truth that I've seen in step one? Am I willing to face my doubt? Am I willing to ask to be shown my current agnosticism? And do I see that my current agnosticism is the same and only a reflection of the current unmanageability, the manifestations of page 52 as they are now? Can I see that that is my agnosticism? Am I willing to face my current situation, surrendered to a self-imposed crisis that I can no longer blame on anyone else or anything else, that I can no longer postpone or that I can no longer evade? Am I willing, without fear, without fear, to face the proposition that God is either everything or He's nothing, to choose that He is or to choose now that He isn't? If you're new, if you're old, if you're in between, please don't think that you can't choose either one. You can do the work from a place to be shown. You can do the work from a place that you choose God is nothing. You can choose that He isn't. You can choose to be shown. You will have a much easier time than those that think they're big-time true believers. Have I faced my doubt? Have I faced my prejudice, my worship of things, people, sentiment, money, myself, the worship I have of my mind, my ideas, my notes, what I've learned? Did I really mean what I said in my set-aside prayer? Do I really want an open mind and a new experience? Or do I want to just add to what I already know? Am I willing to abandon it all utterly? So with the work I've done up to this moment, up to this day, in the first step, body, mind, spirit, with the work I've done in the second step, with looking at what I've seen, that drunk or sober, am I convinced that I'm an alcoholic and or a drug addict, or whatever your truth is, and that my life is unmanageable? Now, sober, can I move my life past where I am, even with the amount of power I currently have? And am I willing to face at this point what I've done with grace, what I do with power, what I do with all that I've been given, and see that within the realization of the grace of God in my life, whether it's one day or 25 years, that in the middle of the realization of the grace of God in your life is where a fearless first step will be? If there's any fear left to face the proposition that God is everything or nothing, then there's a piece of self that has a reservation about alcohol. Because if you're afraid of drinking again, if you're afraid of facing any of this stuff, you will not meet the condition that says you must fearlessly face the proposition God is everything or nothing. And if there is fear, am I willing to look through it and see that there's a part of self that believes I, without God, can do something about those fears? Am I really convinced that no human power can relieve what I suffer from? No human power. And am I willing to believe that God not only can, but that He will for me if I seek Him? And do I believe God will give me the power to seek Him? Am I convinced that my life run on my will is not successful? With the power, with the grace that I've been given, if I've clearly seen the unmanageability that I currently have, if I've really seen the current agnosticism that I have, am I willing to believe that God can and will for me take me past where I am, and that my life as I currently am, when I'm running on self-will, outside of God's will, doesn't work? Can I see clearly that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of what I suffer from, and that driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, I step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate, and that I make decisions based on self at some time in the past, which has placed me in a position to be hurt, confused, and baffled, and at the same time that suffering has created a desire to move past where I am, to be moved past where I am. Can I see the freedom in the fact that my troubles are of my own making and that I am not a victim of the things that I've seen in that unmanageability, in that agnosticism, in that list of areas where I'm running my life on self-will, which will become my inventory? And I would like to ask that anyone who would like to join us after the decision, that we begin the third step prayer together. And this decision is the how and the why of it. And first of all, they will tell me why I need to make this decision. And the reason I need to make this decision is because playing God doesn't work. And how do I make this decision? I simply decide that from hereafter, from this place, with what I've seen in the work up to this point, in the weekend up to this point, in my sobriety up to this point, I have seen that playing God doesn't work, and I'm ready to decide that from hereafter, I would like God to be my director in ways that I might not even know. And I would like to be an actor who wants to quit trying to be a director. I would like to be an agent of God and have Him be my principal. And I would like to be His child. And I would like Him to be my father. And am I willing to face and be rid of any old ideas I have about those principles and really make this decision? What would I like my father to be? What does that mean to me? What would I like my director to be? How would I like to act? How would I like to be? How would I like to be directed? What would it mean for me to be his agent? What does it mean for to be an agent of God? Is it an honor? Is it arrogant? Is it possible? Is it a reality? And to really be a child of God, if that idea could go from your head to your heart, that you are a child of God, you will never, ever have a problem with low self-esteem ever again. Because there's nothing you could ever do, get, accomplish, have, earn, work for, more than the realization in your heart that you are a child of God. Third step prayer. God,
I offer myself to thee, to build with me, to do with me as thou wilt. Leave me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness
to those I would help,
of thy power, thy love, and thy
way of life.
May I do thy will always.
I bow to the sound of the silence and the diamond of the lotus of my heart. Om Mani Padme Hum. There's no amen at the end of that prayer that we just did. And I believe that's because everything you do from the end of that prayer right now today to the end of the next time you say the seven-step prayer is part of one prayer. And in that prayer, I have always been safe and protected.
Four-step. How many of you have written a resentment inventory? Oh, good, good, good.
He never good. Has.
Who are you pointing at, Larry?
Matthew.
How many of you are currently in inventory right now? A few of you. Hands didn't go quite as high, but that's okay.
Same number of hands that are back for the second time in their first year.
We're going to have a little fun with something which we call Theater of the Lie. It probably should be called Theater of the Truth, but...
Or as he'll share with you, it probably should be called Theater of the Truth About the Lie, even if the truth about the lie is true.
There's some things I read in the big book I want to mention again so you'll have a sense of understanding. Maybe give you an explanation. And again, the first time I saw this and as I work with it, as I begin to write inventory, I begin to have some pretty significant experiences, which is why I use it, because it works. It really opened me up in terms of inventory. Face and be rid of that which has me blocked from God. And some of the things I just want to reiterate again is the book talks about we're going to get down to causes and conditions. And if you look up the word condition, it'll refer to condition as a state of being. And then a little bit further on, I read that before you get into what I call the fourth column, the big book makes a reference. It says, in that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancy to real, has the power to kill. So I want to show you all a little bit how that plays out, if you will. If I went into most people's homes, or if I spent just a very minimal amount of time with you, I would be able to identify six or eight, I'll use the words of the big book, stage characters that your ego has manufactured that you think define who you are. If you stop and think about how the ego is developed at birth, the very first interaction is with the parents. And so the first stage character has been born. I'm a son or I'm a daughter. And you get a sense of who you are from an external source, right? And then let's say that you have brothers or sisters. Now you have another stage character that you think defines who you are. I'm a brother or I'm a sister. And then you go along a little bit longer and you get into high school and I guess let's say that you're an athlete. Now you got another one that you think defines who you are. Or maybe you're a computer geek or a nerd, so now you've got another one that defines who you are. Then there's people like us, you know, we're the beer drinkers and the potheads and the antisocials. And, you know, so now we've got, that's another one that defines who we are. And then the first time that you either have sex with yourself or another human being, you now have introduced to another one. Somewhere in there, at least if you're a male, because that's what I am this time around. From the very first time I had my first fight, I got introduced to another one. I like to call him Rambo. He got real well defined as I got into my alcoholism, then got sent to Vietnam and some other stuff. And you ladies have one too. It's called Xena. Some of you very cleverly disguise it, but you all have it. Let's see, and then you go along a little bit longer, and you start dating, and let's say you're, well, if you're in a relationship, those of you who are just, quote, in relationships, but you haven't moved into stage two, which is perhaps commitment, and then stage three, which is engaged, and stage four, which is marriage, soon to be followed by stage five, divorce, but now you have another character that you think defines you. I'm a husband, I'm a wife, I'm a... pay attention to your, not only yourself when you talk, pay attention to other people when they talk, and watch how often they will be talking about a human being and never mention their name and use the word my. My house, my wife, my ex, my, and won't even use their name. And they're completely asleep to what they're doing when they do that. And so then if you go along and in that marriage or in that relationship, you have children, now you have another stage character. Now you're a parent, aren't you? You're a mom and you're a dad. And of course, somewhere along the line, if you're working, you have a career, you have a career person, right? Somewhere along the line, most of us have a part of us that is very much identified with money. I am my money. And so if I just walk into your house, I can get a real sense of all the different stage characters that you think define who you are. And what are we having? We're having some fun here now. Cleaning lady? All right. So are you getting an idea? Now, I want you to take a second, and I want you to kind of think of your own stage characters, and I'll use myself as an example. And then I'll use Joe and I. So, I'm in the world to play the role that God has assigned, so what are some of my roles? Well, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are two different characters, by the way. I'm a spiritual man, Mr. A.A. See? I definitely got a male Rambo in me. I am CEO of a company. Follow me? That defines who I am, correct? What else? I'm a writer. That's another one. I'm a sponsor. That's another one. I am my money. That's another one. I'm a jock. I'm an athlete. That's another one. That's a pretty good start. Every inventory that I've written, and the last one that I wrote, that inventory was written by different parts of those stage characters depending on what individuals or institutions hurt, threatened, or interfered with one of those states of being. I'll give you an example. I wrote some inventory on some employees who work with me. I'm probably not the only one in this room that's had to do that. What stage character do you think, if I have an employee, and my perception is that employee is not showing up, giving the company a fair day's job or being slothful or blah, 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 what stage character do you think is being impacted by that? The CEO, the business person. And my inventory revealed that he wasn't just a little disturbed by this behavior. Because what does he need to be to exist? He needs to be in that position. So anything that hurts, threatens, or interferes with that position, he will experience it as though he's fighting for his very life, because he is. That's who wrote, he wrote some inventory. Now, Mr. AA has been writing inventory for years. Because, you know, there's no police squads going around cleaning all this crap up, you know, and there's just stuff going on in AA, and he's just never satisfied. See, and Mr. AA has an idea of how it's supposed to look, right? Follow the traditions and follow the big book, and yeah, you know, there's some groups in Dallas just not doing that. Can you imagine? And so he gets to write some inventory. But every time I write inventory, these different stage characters are the ones who write the pieces of inventory. Those of you that recently just, if you've gone through any relationship problems, I can assure you, you had a husband or a wife or a boyfriend or girlfriend that wrote some inventory that wasn't getting their way. Remember? So that's the basic concept that I want you to think about as we're going to do some stuff in Theater of the Lie and maybe give you an idea of what you're up against with this stuff. Maybe give you an idea of what the book means when it says resentment is the number one offender. Maybe give you an idea of what it means when it says in that state the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, has the power to kill. So what I like to do when I do Theater of Lie is just I like to find someone who has maybe recently written some inventory they would be willing to share. Just so you know, I could pick anyone in this audience to do this with. You all have stage characters. You all got shit going on. I don't care who you are, because you can't defeat the ego. So I'd like to find someone who's recently written some. You want to volunteer? Come on up. Now, one of the first things we're going to find out is, go ahead and sit down. Some people call this the hot seat. So your name's?
Stacy.
Okay. I want you to give us some general information about the various stage characters that you have operating.
Okay, I'm a mother.
Okay, we got mom. You got that?
Wife.
Wife.
Not yet divorced. Girlfriend.
Wait a minute, say that again. You're divorced?
Not yet.
Oh, not yet.
No.
Okay. And then I heard a girlfriend?
No.
Oh, okay.
Have a boy. Well, yeah, I'm a girlfriend too.
Okay. I'm sorry, I got confused. She's both a wife and a girlfriend with two different men. I got confused. Y'all get that one? Did you catch that? Yeah.
You're an alcoholic?
I'm an alcoholic. Okay. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Spiritual woman?
Spiritual woman.
Okay.
I have a Xena.
Ah,
oh, yeah, I have a big Xena.
Any hobbies, any of that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Then there's the work.
Okay.
There's
career.
My work. Career.
What do you do?
I do billing, but then there's an antique business I'm starting.
Oh, okay.
So there's the antiquer.
Okay.
Let's see what else.
That pretty well define you?
Oh, God, no, I'm sure there's a lot more there.
That'll be a good start for inventory. By the way, I want to distinguish something. This is in the area of sex, you know, that area never talked about in AA, because we all have celibacy as a sane and sound ideal, right? I want you to understand something. How many of you are married? Raise your hands. Okay. So you have a state of being called husband and wife. And virtually every belief system you have came from watching your mother and father and television and the culture and everything else. That's where your third column starts to roll out. But I want you to understand something. You've got a husband and wife. For you wives, I want you to know that your husband has never cheated on you. But the stud will in a minute, because he's got a whole nother agenda. You follow? The same true for your husbands. The wife would never, ever cheat on you, because that is not in her belief system. But that little sex kitten would, because she's got a different agenda. You follow me? See, any of you who are married that have ever written any inventory on your significant other, I assure you that you're writing out your third column. You have an idea of how a wife or husband's supposed to be. You have a complete script. Unfortunately, you never gave it to them, never told them about it. They don't fit it, and you're angry all the time. You see? And so that's some of the stuff that we're going to look at in here. So you got a pretty good idea of this. We got an interesting host of characters here. So who are you resentful at?
Let's try the ex-husband first.
Okay. They're nameless, of course. I understand we're on tape, but can we just give him a name like Paul or something?
Ivars.
Okay. So he actually has a name.
Yeah.
I've noticed this in particular with this concept of my, when it comes to exes, if you give them a name, it's like they still exist or something. You know, it's always exes. you know? Do they have a name? Well, yeah, okay. So it's Ivers? Ivers.